TJU at University of Virginia, which is also a great station. So yeah, I mean, college radio is the best.
What kind of shows did you do?
I was, it was the late 80s, early 90s.
I want to be the machine in your hands and go wherever you go.
Hi, this is Alana from Sawkill. I'm the host of There There on WGXC Acra, Hudson, and Catskill. Radio for open ears.
Oh my God, honey, I just heard some terrible news. The radio station's going off the air.
Going off the air? How will I listen to my samba music? A 1, 2, 3, back. A 3, 2, 1, back. To the side, to the side, to the left.
Honey, you're an excellent samba dancer, but I think this is it for them.
Oh no, I just went to their website, wgxc.org. You can donate monthly, did you know that?
Yeah, you can make one of those one-time donations, but you know what I'm into? Monthly sustaining support.
Oh honey, you're very sustaining, especially when we go and have that delicious spring water in Hudson and the environs.
All right, don't get so frisky, honey. Donate monthly. Choose your amount from the drop-down menu on the old website there, or donate by check. Did you know I can give them my stock donations?
Oh, honey, give them some of that worthless Bitcoin that those children who were sleeping in their cars, they told us to buy the Bitcoin. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, I got some of that Bitcoin, but I got something better, cold hard cash. Donate right now to the best radio station in the land.
Tickets are now available at wavefarm.org/drive-in for an unforgettable drive-in event with Negative Land and Sue C., Matt Most, and Rodney Allen Greenblatt opening. Turn out for Negative Land's legendary sound collage and real-time cinema with Sue C., along with Matt Most's renowned electronic music and sampling culture. This and so much more at the Greenville Drive-In, Friday, May 31st. All to support Wave Farm and WGXE. Tickets are going fast. Get yours now. Drive-In is all one word at wavefarm.org/drive-in.
WGXE underwriting support is provided in part by Bernsey's Multimedia Services, providing the Hudson Valley with a variety of video production services, including help to keep those wedding memories fresh. For more information, visit BernseyMedia.com or call them at 518-860-2751 or email BernseyMMS@gmail.com, BURNSYMMS@gmail.com.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Jim McCabe of New York, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a sustaining supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate and designating an amount of your choosing. Thank you for your support.
You are listening to Transmission Arts Programming on WGXC 90.7 FM.
The global demand for a Gaza ceasefire grows, leaving Biden behind. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With Dennis Moynihan and our weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast. Israel's ongoing bombardment and ground invasion of Gaza, now nearing its 9th month, has provoked unprecedented global outcry. On May 24th, the International Court of Justice, after an emergency hearing in South Africa's genocide case against Israel, ordered Israel to halt its attack on Rafah. In a statement published with the order, one of the court's presiding jurists, Judge Dide Tladi of South Africa, wrote, "There are no more words to describe the horrors in Gaza. The words apocalyptic, exceptionally grave, disastrous, and catastrophic have all been used to describe the current situation, and all seem to pale in comparison to what's unfolding before our very eyes. Almost daily, we're confronted with gut-wrenching accounts of victims and survivors and images of unimaginable suffering, unquote. Rather than heeding the court's order, Israel bombed a refugee tent city outside Rafah in what was described as a safe zone. Independent journalist Shruk Ela spoke to the Democracy Now! NewsHour from Gaza 2 days later, saying,
they launched at least two rockets on a displacement camp that is quite close to the UNRWA logistic log, and people gathered around this space, considering it, you know, as a green area, a safe area. And after the bombing, the area is basically full of tents for displaced people, and the fire set on because of, you know, the tents are basically made of nylon fabrics and wood. The death toll raised until 45, and almost plus 200 got injured.
A man who survived was recorded holding the charred, decapitated body of a child. CNN's reporting the munitions used were made in the United States by Boeing. Meanwhile, not far from the ICJ in The Hague, at the International Criminal Court, ICC Chief Prosecutor Karim Khan petitioned for arrest warrants for Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and Defense Minister Yoav Gallant, as well as three senior Hamas leaders, for war crimes and crimes against humanity. Khan wrote, "Notwithstanding any military goals they may have, the means Israel chose to achieve them in Gaza, namely intentionally causing death, starvation, great suffering, and serious injury to body or health of the civilian population, are criminal," unquote. In a further challenge to Israel, three European nations formally recognized Palestine as a state. Ireland, Norway, and Spain join over 140 other United Nations member states, as well as two UN-recognized non-states, Vatican City and the Sahrawi Arab Democratic Republic, in recognizing Palestinian statehood. In announcing the decision, Ireland's Taoiseach, or Prime Minister, Simon Harris, said,
"On the 21st of January 1919, Ireland asked the world to recognize our right to be an independent state. Our message to the free nations of the world was a plea for international recognition of our independence, emphasizing our distinct national identity, our historical struggle, and our right to self-determination and justice. Today, we use the same language to support the recognition of Palestine as a state. I've spoken with a number of other leaders and counterparts, and I'm confident that further countries will join us in taking this important step in the coming weeks."
Iceland and Sweden recognized Palestine years ago. Slovenia has indicated it will do so by mid-June. On May 10th, the United Nations General Assembly voted on Palestinian membership. 143 countries voted in favor, 25 abstained, and 9 voted against, led by the United States. Membership requires approval by the Security Council, where the U.S. holds veto power. In April, in advance of the General Assembly vote, the Security Council considered a resolution to recommend Palestine receive full U.N. membership. The U.S., as it almost always does on matters critical of Israel, vetoed it. President Joe Biden has publicly called for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza, but his actions speak far louder and far more lethally than his words. It seems the Biden administration has no red line that would force him to halt arms shipments to Israel or take any other significant punitive action to align the U.S. government with almost every other nation on earth. At a White House press briefing on May 28th, CBS News' Ed O'Keefe asked National Security Communications Advisor John Kirby about the deadly strikes on the tent camp near Rafah.
How does this not violate the red line that the president laid out?
As I said, we don't want to see a major ground operation. We haven't seen that at this point.
How many more charred corpses does he have to see before the president considers a change in policy.
We don't want to see a single more innocent life taken, and I kind of take a little offense at the question.
ICC prosecutor Karim Khan included in his Gaza war crimes petition that he, quote, will not hesitate to submit further applications for warrants of arrest, unquote. President Biden and his enablers have the power to end Israel's war on Gaza and the slaughter of civilians there. Their decision not to is criminal. I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Nora E. Edelman of Athens, New York. Sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about Creative Community Radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You, too, can become a WGXC sustaining supporter by investing in community radio every month. Go to WGXC.org and click donate. Thank you for your support. WGXC believes in creative use of the airwaves. WGXC is a program division of the nonprofit arts organization Wave Farm, based in Acre, New York. We are the only station in the country to dedicate significant airtime to radio as an artistic medium. Tune in to Transmission Art and experimental sound programming overnight and on Saturdays, and hear artists from all over the world who sculpt and compose with the airwaves.
All the curtain lights, this is it, the night of nights. No more rehearsing and nursing a part. We know every card by heart. All the curtain lights, this is it, we'll hit the heights. And oh, what heights we'll hit. On with the show, this is it.
Hello, my name is Haley Palumbo, and this is Unknown America on WGXC Acre 90.7 FM. Unknown America is a weekly radio show that casts a light on the lesser-known people, places, events, and otherwise overlooked aspects of the United States of America, be they mysterious, dark, comical, strange, or otherwise valuable. This episode chronicles a visit to the lesser-known Toledo, Toledo, Iowa, a beacon of perfect American liminal space. I used to work a nice corporate job at a desk. When you worked there a certain amount of time, they would give you a solid month off to do with whatever you liked. I chose to take my month shortly after my mother's passing. My initial plan for this time was to grieve in an extended manner and to take a long trip through what I had been jokingly referring to my coworkers as the bargain bin states. Iowa, Nebraska, North Dakota, South Dakota, Wyoming. This was a joke, of course. In reality, I didn't find these states to be that way at all, In fact, to me, they had the capacity to be the most interesting, simply because they were the least known. Same as the deep sea, who knows what one could stumble upon in the dead center of Nebraska? Who's to say the conversation one would have with the teller at a bank in Cody, Wyoming would be any more or less interesting than one with an artist in New York City? The teller may have had more opportunity to meander through the gardens of their own thoughts and to turn small daily occurrences over in their minds, drawing brand new conclusions that do not stem from the opinions and reflections of their peers, but rather a series of gentle personal connections made over the course of a long lifetime in a quiet place. There is value in both a small town mind and a big city mind, and it's unfortunate that sometimes people do not see that. It is very late at night, and I am headed towards Monwai, Nebraska. I'm getting a late start because 1 hour at the world's largest truck stop in Iowa turned into 4 hours. If you ever make it out there, you'll see why. There's a dentist, a barber, a laundromat, a movie theater, restaurants, a tremendous CB and trucker supply store, and a gift shop with every absurd trinket you can think of. If you stopped there with an hour budgeted, you would exceed your hour too. You see, Monwai held my interest because it has one resident. During the 2000 census, the village's population stood at a mere two individuals, Ruby and Elsie Ellier, who were married. Rudy passed away in 2004, leaving Elsie as the sole resident. In her new role as mayor, she granted herself a liquor license and is tasked with annually submitting a municipal road plan to secure state funding for the village's 4 streetlights. It's also home to the Monwai Tavern, a bar managed by Elsie catering to passing travelers and tourists. Additionally, she oversees Rudy's library, a collection of 5,000 volumes established in memory of her late husband. Monwai was as close to an end goal as I had on this trip, although deep down I got the sense that it would be more dictated by the long, thin fingers of grief. Grief is exhausting. Plan as thoroughly as you like, but grief tends to tell you where to go and what to do at the end of the day. I was simply too tired to continue and had to find somewhere to sleep. Maybe I would continue to Monwai in the morning. When I'm entering a place that I've never seen or heard of before from the off-ramp of a highway, even if the place itself is painted with the general color palette of its surrounding state or county, I get this thrill, a feeling of potential that anything could happen, anybody could be encountered, anything could be around the corner. Just a general excitement about learning of a brand new place. I'm addicted to this feeling. I spent so much time driving as a teenager. I drove to rest stops alone. I drove from Naperville, where I grew up, a very nice town in Illinois, to Indiana, just to enjoy the vague differences. I was, and am, crazy about trying new roadside diners, even if the diner is just a part of a chain of the same diner, like Iron Skillet or Perkins. It brings about in me a feeling like I'm an observer, watching truckers whose names I will never know eat their meals and get back on the road. My trip to Toledo, Iowa is not something I had planned for even a moment, nor was it a place that I had heard of until I saw it on a road sign. It could have been absolutely anything. Despite being quite tired, I was thrilled. But as that feeling subsided, it was replaced with something stranger. When I pulled off the dark freeway into Toledo, I wasn't nervous and I didn't feel unsettled, as sometimes I feel that late at night driving. In fact, as I drove a few minutes down the main thoroughfare, I knew I had accidentally discovered the most in-between place I had ever been in my life, a perfect liminal space. Perhaps you're familiar with the term. It's a location of transition established for a person to travel through to get where they're going next. It holds more meaning as a whole, as an idea or concept, than as a standard space where you travel to and stay intentionally. I'll draw you a map of Toledo, a place with a population of just under 3,000, but you have to close your eyes to see it. You get off the highway on the right side, I can't recall the exit. You're immediately greeted with a Motel 6 on your right, a small industrial-type facility a half a mile up the green grass on the right side of the same road, and a large, multi-block shopping plaza that took up a good portion of the town. The shopping plaza area, according to a notebook I'm looking at while I write this, contained the following businesses: State Bank of Toledo, Medicap Pharmacy, Murph's Creamery and Grill, Quickstar, and Dollar Fresh Market. It's rural, but not too rural, and as flat as one would expect. The streetlights are few and far between, and they cast the world in a quiet yellow light. The silence is astounding, quieter than any place I've ever been. The only things that I can hear are the exceedingly rare cars driving past on the freeway and the warm hum of electrical boxes. It feels simultaneously pulled from a dream, but also like it has no memory. The spawn point of all warm life, that which upon birth pauses for a beat, then shuffles out towards more opportune terrestrial living, towards the ocean, or far Canada, or even just Iowa City. Here for a moment, not meant to stay. The largest commercially owned business in Toledo was a grocery store, Fairway Meat and Grocery, perhaps a chain in Iowa, but nowhere else. The awning was red and yellow, and the words on the awning had somewhat of a carnival look to them, jaunty. The light that emitted from it was butter yellow, bright as if the place was open. Why do stores keep their lights on all night? I pulled my car up to it and got out and looked in a window. And exactly as one may assume, no one was inside. But the shelves inside held boxes of an even mix of foods I'd grown up eating and foods I'd never heard of or seen. A particularly memorable item was a tall cylinder, red, that simply said, "Iowa's Best Biscuit." Biscuit mix is what I figured, but what made a biscuit mix a uniquely Iowan biscuit mix, I was unsure about. Down the road a bit from the grocery store was a laundromat where I'd do my laundry the next day, a stone's throw from a trailer park and a hair salon. Across the road was an additional small industrial processing facility of some sort, and in sight was the Motel 6 I'd chosen to stay at. I drove to it, the only business that was in my lexicon of recognizable locations in this town other than a Casey's gas station, and parked. Outside, I was met with more dead silence. There were two things of note nearby: a small fenced-in de facto dog park that it looked like somebody built with chicken wire for their two highly obedient dogs, which happened to be sitting inside of it, and a Chinese restaurant called A9 Chinese Restaurant. Small, with a red awning. I wondered if it could possibly be the best Chinese food I had ever eaten and decided to give it a try tomorrow if I felt up to it. More likely than that, it would just be okay, which would be fine too. I swung my camouflage bag and suitcase over my shoulder and locked up my car and approached the Motel 6. I opened the door and looked around. The lobby of the motel was normal, but it also had that way about it when a franchise owner tries to put a spin on things. A couple of odd decorative choices here and there. There was a large rug on the ground covered in a tropical fish print that had an exceedingly normal couch on top of it. A poster sun-bleached nearly beyond recognition behind the desk said, September 11th, 2001, "We will never forget," with an eagle flying past a flag. The eagle looked angry. A sign next to the check-in desk said, "Free breakfast," in a Times New Roman font, but bore no other information at all. The light was fluorescent and gave the scene an alien glow. The clerk was friendly and functioned like one with no internal clock, not a hint of exhaustion on her face given the time of day. I was worried that my last-minute check-in request would annoy her. "Hi, I'd like a room," I said. "Of course, not a problem. Anybody with you? Did you want one bed, two?" "Oh, it's just me. Any room works fine for me, whatever you like." "Great," she says. She punches some things into the computer. I always wonder what it is exactly that's being done on the computer when they're doing this. It's probably pretty standard stuff, but the fact that I never get to see the screen while they're doing it drives me nuts. It could be anything. "What brings you through town? You don't look like the sort of person we get around, especially this late. Usually it's workers on the road." I paused for a moment. Typically I would say something generic, but I felt driven to engage. "Well, I got a bunch of time off, so I sort of planned a long road trip." She laughed. "Why out here for a road trip?" "Well, I wanted to go to this town that's up in Nebraska. It only has one person living in it. I wanted to meet her and maybe interview her or just have a drink with her." She stopped typing and thoughtfully looked up into space. "Why is only one lady living there? Did she have a husband that died?" "Yes, that's precisely what happened. She had her husband living with her, but he ended up passing away. She started a memorial library in his name. The town is called Manuai. If my husband died, I don't think I'd want to live all by myself. I wonder why she chooses to live that way. I suddenly think of my family. After my mom died, we didn't communicate all that well. We still don't. I have hope that things will rebuild themselves, and I know I have not been putting in enough effort on my end. I've just had a lot on my mind. A person being there and then being gone is a lot to comprehend. The laughter, the resentment, her baking, her unusual way she loved. It's strange for a person that dynamic and strange and frustrating to not be in the world anymore. I wouldn't want to live all by myself either, I say. "Well, that'll be $56. You're in room 423. Here's your key, and let me know if you need anything. Breakfast is 6 to 8. Young, she had a smile with one front bottom left tooth missing a little bit of it. Blonde hair in a ponytail, an angular face, and she either smelled like a warm blueberry candle or there was one nearby. I noticed she had a cigarette behind each ear, held like a pencil. I assume that she put one behind her ear, forgot about it, and then put the other behind her other ear. She noticed me staring at them. She laughed. One is for my husband. In high school, every other day, one of us would bring the other a cigarette, and we would smoke them together in the parking lot. He drives a truck, so he's on the road all of the time, and I haven't seen him for 2 weeks. I wanted to make him laugh before we have dinner and he gets back on the road again. He's David." Before I can say anything, she says, "I like it here because it's quiet. I don't mind David being gone too much." There's a brief moment of quiet. "Well, thanks. Have a good morning or night," I say, whatever time it is. "I will. Sleep well. Remember that there's breakfast. I'll remember." My room is on the first floor, and when I open the curtains, I can see my car and the little dog area that I described before. It's about 2:30 a.m. I disrobe, turn all the lights off, and turn the television on to the Weather Channel, as is tradition when I'm in a motel in a strange and new place and am attempting to sleep. I remember it's something my mother and I had in common that we did not learn about until later in life. I imagined her in a motel room in another dimension with her head on her pillow, listening to the weather report for the astral plane. It made sense in Toledo to think of our heads on the opposite sides of the same pillow, mine on top and hers on bottom, like we're so close to phasing through dimensions and getting to see each other again, like she's mere inches away. What does her motel room look like? Why is she there? Is she by herself or is she with Steve? I get the feeling she's by herself. Is it day or night wherever she is? Is she just waking up or laying down to sleep? I hope wherever she is, even if it's nowhere, that she's comfortable and that a little television is playing her the Weather Channel. I looked out the window at the parking lot and think of all the times I've stayed in motel rooms. I've never had a motel stay that felt quite like this one. I was there for almost no reason. I was alone. I was somewhere I had not only never been before, but had never heard of before, and knew I would likely never return to. I still wasn't sure what day it was. I stared up at the ceiling. I couldn't sleep. I slipped my shoes on and walked down one of the long hallways that led to the lobby. The clerk was there. "Everything okay?" She sounded genuinely concerned. It was nice. "Yeah, just can't sleep. I'm going out to my car for a few minutes." I opened the door and went outside. It was just as dark and quiet as it had been an hour or so ago, save for the Chinese restaurant's open sign being on for some mysterious reason. The two dogs were still sitting in their makeshift pen. I went over by my car and got inside and drove absentmindedly back over to the parking lot in front of the grocery store and let my car idle and got out of it. I tried to place how I was feeling. I realized it was something new. It's beautiful to unlock a new feeling. I felt a shatterproof equanimity that no scientists anywhere could explain. The mind-eviscerating scramble of how it feels when God takes someone you love away felt a sudden, swift, and unanimous resolution. For just a moment, complicated and dark thoughts about mortality fell away, and it was just me, my uncombed hair, the car stereo tuned to barely audible AM, my mind clear like a glass of cold water. I felt born again and ready to start over, like I had discovered some divine origin point. I saw nobody driving, nobody on foot, and only a small handful of lights on in the trailers and homes. Saturated in the dim, butter-yellow light of the grocery store, I held nothing in my hands and stood very still in a little world of multipurpose facilities, the purpose of which I could not know. Patchy green and brown grass, a place where which to get a hamburger and medicine, and above me, a vast network of stars, untainted by the collective blinding lights of a big city that demands your participation, screams at you that it needs you. Toledo didn't seem to need much of anything from me. It didn't seem to need much of anything at all, and felt like it would be there until the end of time. I stood there a couple more minutes, went back to the motel, and fell asleep. I woke up around 6 a.m., just in time for breakfast, which was a waffle iron, a bowl of batter, a few tall Tupperware containers of cereal and milk, and a couple other things. I ate in their small dining room alone, handed the new clerk my key, and left. When packing up, I realized that I had to do laundry, as I had been on the road for a few days. I remembered the laundromat near the trailer park and decided to head over. Toledo during the early morning is what one would think it would be in a town of 3,000. Cars, but not enough to call what was happening proper traffic, and a few people here and there. I drove about 2 minutes to the laundromat and got out of my car with my suitcase. Inside the laundromat was me and one other woman at the very far end. We didn't interact in any way. She may not even have noticed that I was there. The motif was flowers, a garden theme. White painted fences separated the washing machines, and a sun was painted on the wall. There was a community bulletin board hanging on the wall advertising dance lessons, lawn mowing, and some other household services. I put 75 cents into a box on the wall in exchange for a little box of detergent and got started doing my small pile of laundry. Something I liked about the laundromat was that there was no music playing. That way, I could just take in the ambient sound. I liked hearing the clothes go round and round and the woman shuffling around at the other end of the store. While things were drying, I fiddled around with my Video 8 camera and took some shots of the walls, laundry machines, and for some reason myself in the bathroom mirror. Eventually, the other woman left and I folded up my laundry and left as well. At that point, I leaned against my car outside and wondered what to do next. I decided to pick a direction and drive. I had 3 weeks to kill, after all. I ended up in a small town in Iowa where I came across the American Gothic House purely on accident, believe it or not, which is a story for another time. Sometimes when I come across a small town I like, I will visit it repeatedly to go to a diner of interest or just a spot I enjoy. But I knew I would likely never see Toledo again. I think it played its role in my life just as it was meant to, and visiting again would undo a part of a story that was already written, mess with the fabric of reality. So I decided to leave it be. There was one last thing I wanted to do, though. I pulled into the parking lot of the red and yellow grocery store with a $5 bill in my hand and bought a container of the Iowa's Best biscuit mix. It was a plain red cylindrical tube with bold white writing and a modest ingredient list. The packaging was so basic that it sort of seemed like it came from a company that distributes food to prisons and schools. I would make the biscuits a few weeks later. They were okay. I walked back to my car and got inside, headed towards the freeway, leaving quiet Toledo behind. I drove past the motel, past the makeshift dog enclosure, and past the Chinese restaurant. I thought of my mother briefly for reasons unknown. I wondered if there were any other places like Toledo. If there were, I decided definitively that I would only ever find them on accident. This has been Unknown America on WGXC Acre 90.7 FM. Haley Palumbo signing off.
For some reason or another, you sound a little taller on radio.
Still.